Okay, Andrew, thank you very much for agreeing to talk to me. Safe to say you're a successful punter, author, journalist and racehorse owner. So how did you first get into this game of ours?
I think I must have inherited it from both grandfathers and it skipped a generation. One of them was a bookies runner. And I remember watching the ITV racing, sat on the armchair and pretending I was a jockey back in the day. But yeah, went to university, met some friends who were into racing, went racing for the first time at Leicester, and it just went from there, really. And that was almost 30 years ago now, longer than I care to remember.
So when did you make the transition from, I assume, mug punter to being one that actually wins?
It took several years, and I remember buying Nick Morden's book, Betting for a Living, and on a Saturday with the money that I'd normally use for punting, and just read that cover to cover twice, and that got me into things like speed figures and draw bias and form study, and breaking horses' form down and trying to work out what their ideal conditions were, and that's what I sort of specialise in, really.
Okay, so when we first met, you were working for a well-known Leicestershire bookmaker. When did you start working on course?
Well, I used to have a normal job, and was gainfully employed in the footwear industry, going back a long time now. And I was always trying to get into racing, to make it my job. And I got a lucky break, really, when the internet first came along, because I used to put race previews on a horse racing discussion forum, the Final Furlong, and somebody from the Racing Post saw them and asked me to contribute to a book he was writing about draw bias. So, so that was the first thing I ever had published. And from then, I started, had an idea for my own book. Don't know if you remember the Trent Horses books I used to do for Raceform. And so then got a book published and then got made redundant, and that gave me the impetus to do other bits and pieces. And compiling odds for Paddy Power, doing tissues for jumps racing, handicaps mostly. And then through the connection with Paddy Power, got to meet Martin of Leicester, the Silver Fox, and he offered me a job to work for him on course. So I became his clerk and form man. So my job was to carry the kit, take bollockings, and advise him which horses to go with and which horses to stand.
So how long did you work on course?
It was a couple of years, I think, in total. And then got the chance to work as a spotlight writer for the Racing Post. And I think one too many days standing in the rain at Hereford with Martin of Leicester yelling money without work in one ear and Neville Emery in the other ear, and decided if I wanted to not go deaf in the near future, the indoor life was for me.
And do you still go racing now?
Yes, when I'm not on William Hill Radio, I tend to be at the track. So, sometimes three or four times a week.
So you also went into racehorse ownership with the genius of George Nympton, Nick Williams. How did that come about?
Yeah, I was bookmaking at Worcester many years ago. I think it was 2003, and setting up the kit. And this guy came up to me and he said, "What price is my horse in the first?" I said, "Oh, yeah, which is your horse?" And he said, "He's the biz." I said, "Oh, are you the owner?" He said, "No, I'm the trainer, Nick Williams." I said, "Oh, yeah, nice to meet you." And I'd written about one of his horses in one of my books, a horse called Sully's Hope. So I said, "Oh, well, how's Sully's Hope?" He said, "Dead, broke a leg on the gallops." It wasn't a great start to the conversation. I thought he was going to walk off after that, but he stayed and had a chat. And so I said, "Oh, well, your horse, well, it was around 11-2. There's a non-runner now, and probably going to be a 9-2 shot." And he said, "Not 16-1 then?" I said, "No, where'd you get that from?" He said, "Oh, it's in the race card." I said, "Oh, the tissue in there is not worth the paper it's printed on." So I started talking about the race and about one or two of his horses. Forgot all about it. And that day, He's the Biz did the business, and under Polly Gundry, and won that race fairly comfortably. And didn't think anything. I think I had a tenner on at the time, and didn't see the guy again until later that same year, about 4 months later. Comes up to me again, same track, Worcester, same horse, he's the biz. He says, what price will my horse be today? And I didn't need any more hints than that, and I think I was straight onto a bookie to have 100 quid on, and he's the biz won at, I think it was 8-1 that day. So I thought, well, if I ever get the money together to be able to have a horse in training or a share in one, then I'd have it with Nick Williams. And fortunately that came to fruition a few years later with a horse called the Risky Viking. I remember having a 5% share in after going to an open day at the yard. And he was a real old plodder, proper staying chaser. He won the Devon Marathon over 4 miles on soft ground at Exeter, going back to 2007, I think it was. My first share in a winner as an owner.
So after the Risky Viking, you struck gold with Rev de Sibilla.
That's right. And I had shares in two horses in the Paul Duffy Diamond Syndicate colours, Quasar Dudairies and Rev de Sibilla. Rev was a relatively cheap purchase, cost £5,000. Had a 15% share, and Nick Williams said, he's a potential star, but we've got to put him in a field for a year. He's got to do some growing. We got him as a juvenile, and he didn't run until the following year. Finished sixth in a maiden hurdle at Chepstow at 16-1, beaten about 30 odd lengths. And the genius of George Nipton, Mr. Nick Williams, then decided to run him in a Grade 2 hurdle at the open meeting at Cheltenham the following month. And having finished us sort of six in a maiden hurdle, wasn't expecting a great deal. And before the race in the paddock, he's basically saying we will finish third or fourth. And he says he's improved massively, and we're going to be running a big race today. And I said to Daryl Jacob before he went out on, I said third will be a lot better than fourth, Daryl, for the each way bet. And bet him each way at 66-1 and 50s, and I think the SP was 40-1. He's managed to finish third. Getting much closer to the R de Rien de Sivilla, horse of Paul Nichols, who beat him at Chepstow. And then from then, he ran six in the Triumph Hurdle later that same year, had his novice status retained for his second season, and we went all out for the Neptune Hurdle at the Cheltenham Festival, which was on my 40th birthday. I think you'll remember this well, Simon, because you helped me celebrate afterwards. And Rev had never lost a race when he'd been in front, sort of in the closing stages. And he took it up between the last two in that, 2010 Neptune. Traded at 1.13 in running. And then Peddler's Cross rallied to get back up. And we were second. So disappointed for a fraction of a second. And then we decided to go out and celebrate as though we'd won anyway. And several hours later, I think we were still celebrating. So yeah, that was one of the great days. We had some fantastic times with him. Went to Punchestown several times, Auteuil in France, where he won a massive race with a £250,000 pot. And sadly, he died on the race course at Kelso earlier this year. But he gave us some fantastic memories, and he was a wonderful horse.
Well, you mentioned the Scoop Sixes earlier, and I was lucky enough to be part of the syndicates when they won. Can you go back over those Scoop 6 years and tell us how that started?
Yeah, I think there was a big carry forward back in 2006, and decided to have a small go at it, and got the place fund up, and that gave me a few quid in the account to have a proper go the following week, and decided to put a syndicate together. And you were responsible for selling shares to various people you were working with on course at the time, like bookmakers, workmen, and people who worked for the likes of SIS and Turf TV. And I think I staked 1,500 quid. I wanted about 300 quid for myself, but you didn't sell as many shares as I'd hoped for. And I ended up with about £800 worth, so just over 50%. And to cut a long story short, after Teofilo won, I think it was the Dewhurst, We were one of many winners of the Scoop 6. There were 50-odd people who'd won it that day. And I think it was £15,000 plus the firm we were doing the bet with paid a 20,000 bonus. So, we got 18 grand and went for the bonus fund the following week. And that was the St. Simon Stakes at Newbury, when we were one of only five people who went for the 15-2 winner short skirt. and copped another 100,000 quid or thereabouts. So that was the first time we won it, and we went on to win it twice more, including, I think there's a record pot of like £4.5 million in the win fund, and we were one of eight people to win it, although some people thought there were nine winners.
Yeah, tell us what happened there then.
Yeah, I was at the time I was punting professionally in running, living in Canary Wharf and going to a horse racing trading room every day. And after that Scoop 6 win, got a phone call from Harry Finlay's form man, and basically said, you know, Andrew, have you won the Scoop? I said, you know, yes, I have. He said, right, you know, yeah, we've got a couple of tickets or whatever, and I'm trying to get all the winners together so we can conclude next week for the bonus fund, which was over £1.5 million. He said, is Peter Norton part of your syndicate? I said, no, you know, I don't know the guy. And he said, oh, you know, because, you know, apparently he's won it as well, but that makes nine winners. So we're trying to work out how this, you know, how there's only eight people confirmed. So that was a bit of a strange one. And it turned out that Peter was £50 into the bet via a friend of mine, and caused a bit of a confusion at the time.
So you colluded with Harry Finlay, and what happened on the bonus?
Yeah, well, this was the it was the Hennessy, Newbury, of course, and yeah, there were 15 runners in it. We had eight tickets between us, and I remember turning up the track thinking, oh, this is going to be fantastic. All these Scoop 6 winners will be sat around a conference table, you know, arguing over which horses to include, which ones to leave out, and you know, it's going to be a fascinating sort of, you know, meeting of minds. And it turned out the idea was just to put the first eight in the betting in and back the other seven and guarantee some money. So, you know, reluctantly, we left out the winner, Madison de Burleigh, which is one of two I'd tipped up in race form update earlier that week. But, yeah, managed to get a few quid anyway.
So the heady days of betting professionally solely for your income, I think, are sort of gone now. What is it you actually do now? And why was it so difficult to make a living, you know, as a punter originally?
Yeah, now I'm more journalist and broadcaster than full-time punter. Write a column weekly for Racing and Football Outlook called Between the Lines, concentrating on draw bias and track bias. I do spotlights for the Racing Post. Been doing that on and off now for over 10 years. So that's you know, giving a comment for each individual horse and doing the betting forecast and then the tips at the end. So that's the kind of thing you see on the walls in your local betting shop. I also work for William Hill Racing Radio. Usually up there a couple of times a week, you know, giving preview as an analysis on all the British and Irish racing. So you know, I love doing that. That's a great part of the job. And of course, for many years now as well, I've been writing daily columns for gg.co.uk, track bias diary and trend horses columns. So yeah, I'm kind of gainfully employed again now. Because, yeah, going back to those sort of 2008, 2009 times down in London, I think my break-even amount I needed each month to pay mortgages, horse race training fees and all expenses was about 8,000 quid. So you do put yourself under massive pressure when you've got to win that just to break even. So it yeah, can take its toll on your well-being, and basically it's a massive mindfuck.
So what's your strategy as a punter when you when you're doing the form these days, when you put your tips up, etc.? What are you looking for?
Yeah, a lot of what I do now is sort of database driven, and so I use Proform Racing. I've got almost 500 betting systems sort of in the, you know, stored in the database, and any qualifiers on those systems will be thrown up each day. So I'll work through those. I've then also got my horse tracker runners. So, you know, every week I'll go through the past week's racing. I'll look for horses who've run well from bad draws, horses that have, you know, done well coming from off the pace in a race that's favoured those who've raced prominently. So I'll work through those as well. I also use ratings. Several years ago, I used to use the RSB ratings, Racing System Builders. They were really decent ratings. Got into those through a professional gambler called the Cowboy, who used to basically employ me to analyse the ratings and work out, you know, in which conditions they were good, and come up with various betting systems on those. But yeah, nowadays it's sort of mostly race form ratings and race form speed figures that I use.
Andrew, you mentioned the in running. Now, I do remember being in Canary Wharf one day and I sat next to you watching the same races on identical computers. I lost 100 quid and you won about 5 grand. Uh-huh. There's obviously a big skill involved with it. You must have some good and bad memories from those halcyon days of professional in running punting.
Yeah, that's right. This is when the in running game was probably a little bit easier than it is now. There was plenty more money in the markets, and you know, you could play 4 seconds behind on SIS and still expect to win. But yeah, there were some memorable times. Sort of 2008, there was a horse called Make My Dream at Windsor, which was one of three on my shortlist for the race, but I was worried about the wide draw. So I've watched the horse leaving the stalls, and he's floated out and got a, you know, got across and towards the rail, got a nice position. So I've had a bet on him then, about 16-1, it was a £50 click. And you know, bet him again throughout the race, and it's a photo finish, but he's, you know, I'm pretty sure he's got up and won. But the commentator's called the wrong horse because Make My Dream's number cloth is folded over, so it looks like a different number. And the photo finish betting's come up on Betfair, and it's flashed up 1,000 Make My Dream. So I've hit the button and got 15 quid matched at 1,000, the rest about even money, I think. And he's been confirmed the winner. So I managed to get 15 grand about a winner in a photograph, which was quite ridiculous. But there was one or two other memorable ones. Quasar Dudairis, a horse who won a maiden hurdle at 33-1 at Hereford, so which I owned a quarter share in. You know, I didn't go racing that day, but I was in Canary Wharf pressing the button. That was a decent result, as was Equiano's King Stand Stakes win at Royal Ascot when he came down the stand side. But yeah, it wasn't all glory, and usually the worst days coincided with the worst hangovers. And I remember going in there on New Year's Day one day after having about 4 hours sleep and doing an absolute fortune. And jet lag was also to blame once. I came back from Vegas, slept on the plane, so I thought I was relatively fresh. Got back to Gatwick about 9 o'clock in the morning, and then 3 hours later was in the trading room. And again, just knocked out a small fortune in the space of a few hours. But yeah, great days living down there, going to a trading room every day with sort of 20 other professional punters. And yeah, would definitely go back and do it again if I could.
Well, I know, following your selections for the last decade, that even if you sniff looking like winning, it's extremely difficult to get on, even if you have a modest stakes like 20 quid like I do. How do you get around getting your bets on?
Well, there's various options. Obviously, betting exchanges, although the premium charge has affected my ability to use one of them, but also on course. And you know, there is a lot of value to be had on course. When I was at Nottingham last week, bet two horses in a race. Now, one of them, you know, on Betfair at the time, is 6.8 to back, so just over 11-2. There's 4 or 5 books on track are going 11-2. You can, you know, back that with the fractions. There's no commission, there's no premium charge, and you know, a lot of on-course bookies will go tight to the to Betfair prices. So it's just a bit of a pain if you've seen a bigger price about your horse the night before or in the morning. You can't really get on. So William Hill will lay me a decent bet, and but yeah, most of the others have closed me down several years ago, unfortunately.
So the Scoop 6, Andrew, you were very successful at it, and I know for a fact that we also had a lot of near misses as well. Why did you decide to scrap the Scoop 6 syndicates and turn it in?
Yeah, the bet lost all its value, really. When so Betfred took over the Scoops, the tote, and they decided that they wanted to include all the hardest handicaps every day. Because remember, the first time we won it, the last leg of the Scoop was the Group 1 Dewhurst Stakes. Teofilo was the 11-8 favourite that day. That was our banker in the last leg, and he did touch 50-1 in running actually before going on to win that race. But yeah, it just got to the stage where the money in the win fund didn't create value when you were looking for 6 winners in impossible handicaps. It used to be much more fun when there were sort of, you know, these seven runner Group One races that they'd include, because you could get, it wasn't always the favourite that won those. Clive Britton could come in with a 50-1 winner at somewhere like Newmarket, and if you included those sort of horses in there, there was massive value. But yeah, it just got to the stage of trying to sort of throw £5,000, £10,000 into the bet. You weren't chasing enough money. You needed a seven-figure rollover to make it value, and that just rarely happens nowadays.
And you didn't confine yourself to the Scoop Six. You had a successful jackpot, if I remember rightly.
Yeah, that's right. And that was down to you as well, I think, on that particular day. I was on the train coming back from Sheffield, where I'd been to see family, and then you phoned me up and said, "Oh, there's a jackpot rollover at Huntingdon. If you want to have a crack, you know, I'll come in with you." So on the train on the way back to Market Harborough, worked out a jackpot perm, and then couldn't get a signal on my dongle, so I couldn't put the bet on. So I thought I had a choice: I could carry on or get off the train at the station and use the Wi-Fi in the cafe. So decided to jump off the train, put the bet on. Don't think we threw a massive amount at it, about £300, and then we won a best part of £26,000. So you can give yourself a pat on the back for that, Simon.
Trumpet blow.
That's another bet that rarely gets decent pots now. I think last week it wasn't won for a couple of days at Newmarket, and at the end of it there's only about £7,000 in the pot. So hopefully when Betfred are no longer involved with the tote, then things will improve.
You talked earlier about Martin of Leicester, and you've also talked about hangovers. And one of the worst hangovers I ever had was after the Ryan Moore party, which was celebrating getting a nice few quid when Ryan Moore won the Jockeys Championship. How did the success? There's quite a few successful years punting on Jockeys Championships, plus one particularly painful near miss. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, that's again down to the influence of my old boss Martin of Leicester. He very rarely bet, and one of his expressions was never bet on anything with a round ball, so he wouldn't bet on football, golf, tennis, anything like that. But he did used to study the jockey's title every single year. Wouldn't always bet on it, but every now and again a good value bet would come up. And when Ryan Moore won the title, I think I was earning £80 a day as a bookmaker's clerk, and the first bet I struck was a £10,000 to 1. And in total, I think I had £4,000 on to win 17. And people say there's no value in betting odds on, but I think the last bet I had was at 11-2 on, when we worked out that even if he dropped dead on that particular day, he'd still be champion jockey because the others couldn't catch him. And I think that was the final bet that closed my Stan James account. That was several years ago. But with the jockey's title, it's a case of trying to find out who can win it and who wants to win it, because it's a hell of a lot of work, driving around the country. And if you live in Newmarket and you've ridden two winners at Newmarket on a Saturday afternoon, do you really want to jump in the car and drive to Wolverhampton to ride one in the last? And finding out the jockeys who are willing to do that, it's got the backing of a good agent, and who also are not going to be taking 3 weeks off because of whip bans and that sort of thing. So we study it intently every single year. Don't always have a bet, but Ryan Moore was one of the successful ones. We had a near miss with Robert Winston. I remember backing him to win five figures, and coming back from a night out, putting the teletext on, which shows how long ago that was, to see if he'd had any winners at the night meeting. And the CFAX headline read, "Winston injured in horror fall." I went to bed convinced and I dreamt it. The next morning, came back down to look at his odds on the exchanges, and he was out to about 50-1. So, we had a bit of a touch last year as well with Jim Crowley. Bet him at 9-2 when he was behind Sylvester D'Souza. And again, he had the backing of a good agent and managed to become champion jockey. But it's something that I will look at every year. We've not got involved this year because SDS was always going to win and was always a short price. But next year, perhaps we'll have another go.
And while we're talking about unusual bets, you've had a touch or two on the Eurovision Song Contest, if I remember.
Yeah, that's right. That's another thing that I like to bet on most years. And back in the day, you know, before the internet, used to get the CDs sent round of all the songs on. And there were three guys involved in it, and one of them would watch the videos of the performances, the other one would listen to the songs, and the other one would study voting patterns and work out who was going to vote for who. And these three people went away, all came up with their shortlist, and at the top of every shortlist one year was Ukraine. And they were at a 14 to 1 shot. I remember, like, the balloon went up at about 11 o'clock on a Monday morning, and said, right, you know, back Ukraine, have as much on as you can. And I think the first bet I got knocked back to 14 tenors at Skybet. There might even been Surrey Racing back then. And yeah, so just going around the shops trying to get as much as you can on a novelty event is not easy, but that was good fun. And it's the greatest event to watch if you've had a bet, the Eurovision Song Contest, because it's like a 3 hour long photo finish. It's just agonising as the votes come in, and you know, whether you get 10 points or nil.
Okay, Andrew, I expect some people are seething watching these videos about all your successes, or other people may be thinking, now, you know, there's somebody I'll try and emulate, see if I could be as successful as Andrew. So what, for a person getting into the game now, is there still money to be made? Can you still beat the bookies?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I know plenty of people who do it, and plenty of people are a lot more successful than I am. You know, people who compile their own speed figures, and you know, are studying sort of several hours a day to get an edge. But you know, if you're working full time and you haven't got that sort of you know, time on your hands, then ideally you need to specialise. You know, look at a particular track. For example, Southall, the only 5% course in the country. Concentrate on horses that run well there, or look at a particular race distance, you know, concentrate on sprinters, or you know, concentrate on staying chases over 3 miles or further, and perhaps, you know, look at the, you know, classier horses as well. You know, maybe ignore Group One racing, and which is analysed to death, you know, in the press. Maybe look at sort of Class 2, 3, and 4 races. You know, perhaps knock out the Class 6 stuff, and you know, go down that route. But you know, just try and read as much as you can. I think you know, Nick Morden's book Betting for a Living is probably still relevant. There's other good books out there as well, and I'm looking forward to reading Harry Finlay's biography as well, which has just come out.
Yeah, Andrew, talking about good days and bad days, we all realize that Sir Anthony McCoy is an absolute genius, but every time he's mentioned as being an absolute genius, they show that video, don't they? You know the one I'm talking about?
Oh yes, that's Wichita Lineman's win in the William Hill Trophy Handicap at the Cheltenham Festival in 2009. And you and I and several others were on Maljamar at big prices. I think we were on an anti-post at 33s, 25s, 20s, went again on the day at 16 to 1. Got him in multiple bets with a couple of winners as well. And Maljamar, you know, looks the likely winner. And then AP McCoy has conjured up an incredible late burst from the winner, and we've been done a neck. I still blame Armaloft Alex, who put their hand up on the run-in and gave a shout of aye aye just as we got fetched out. But what was worse was every time you went back to the track, they'd show the highlights of previous Cheltenham festivals and previous Cheltenham races, and there was always that race and that finish and what could have been. We backed him to win an absolute fortune. And when AP McCoy retired or hit the 4,000 winner mark, they always showed that video again, and it still brings me out in cold sweats.
New Betting People interviews are published every week at Star Sports. Exclusive interviews with the key people from the world of sports betting. Check out our full library of interviews at starsportsbet.co.uk, begambleaware.org, over 18 only.